Please be seated. So there's a wonderful scene in the recent Netflix show, The Crown. How many of you have followed that a little bit? Followed it one season, maybe into the second season. I like the first season a lot more than the second season. There was a couple of good episodes in the second season, but of course that's just my opinion. In the first season, though, there was a scene of great poignance. It was when the Queen Mother was vacationing on the coast of northern Scotland at a friend's estate, and it's set several years after the death of her husband, King George. And the cinematography, of course, is magnificent. I guess Netflix has no budget constraints. It juxtaposes Scotland's rugged, windswept coastline with this figure walking the beach in her grief and solitude. And the existential statement is very powerful. No one, rich or poor, powerful or weak, is exempt from searing loss. At some point, the Queen Mother glimpses this large estate in the distance, precariously perched right on the edge of a bluff, and she hikes over and finds that the place is run down. Its appearance in and out resonates with her inner feeling, the grief she's experiencing, and she meets the owner and begins negotiations to buy the place. Some visits later, they're walking along the beach back towards their friend's estate when two royal officials who've been desperately trying to find the Queen Mother stumble down a sandy embankment in their loafer while trying to appear dignified in her presence. It's quite hilarious. Mum, may we please have a word? It's at that very moment that the penny drops, and the gentleman who owns the precariously perched castle recognizes her. Western civilization loves stories like this. We set them up all the time. We love the idea that there might be among us someone who becomes famous, a secret prince or princess, either already or in the making, and we'd be right. But more on that in a minute. In societies influenced by the Christian faith, there is a kind of deep irony at this point. For we no longer remember the source of this fascination. In Luke, after the resurrection, two grief-stricken followers are, quote, talking with each other about all these things that had happened. Jesus himself came near and went with them, but their eyes were kept from recognizing him. Or the more generalized global conclusion of John's gospel, he was in the world and the world came into being through him, yet the world did not know him. The season of Epiphany as a whole celebrates the inexpressible event present in this one, with an ongoing eye to show how his light is revealed in ways that respect our dignity to either accept it, ignore it, or indeed forget that it exists. But Epiphany is more than this, more than how we come to this awareness of God, more than how we come to these penny-dropping moments. It is also about, more powerfully, it's about how we might yet come to be what is revealed. To not only recognize the one among us in quite shocking ways, but then by the mystery of this one's presence, become in ourselves what he came to reveal. And so it makes sense that the story of the Transfiguration has become the story that we should look at on the last Sunday of this season. It's both the epitome of the light stories, from the story of the star that led the Magi to the extraordinary phrase that Jesus flings out in the Sermon on the Mount, towards his ragtag group of followers, "You are the light of the world." And so it's a story that opens doorways to the past, to the present, and to the future. To the past, we can see that with all the difference that Jesus makes, at the Transfiguration, it is Moses and Elijah that appear beside him, the law and the prophets. However misunderstood, however much fear the giving of the law instilled in the Israelite people, this was, as we read in our first reading, a moment of God's glory, by which we mean God's closeness to human beings, a revelation of loving intent. The giving of law, of God's law in particular, is the beginning of culture. It removes us from our animal survival mode that pits everyone against everyone. To be able to know that rest is required of the nation on the seventh day, that parents are to be respected, that commitments are meant to be kept, is the foundation of a life that can then be lived in new freedom to create. Because now we're not always just looking over our back trying to protect ourselves. Now that's the theory. And to a large degree, we Canadians are the beneficiary of a vastly improved life because of the rule of law. Jesus' transfiguration was a penny-dropping moment for the first followers because they would have remembered the stories of Moses' own shining face. And so Jesus does not stand in contradiction to his Jewish past, but as one who has come to expose how the heart can be transformed in order that God's intentions might yet come to fruition, that the full spirit of the law, which is love, might be expressed over and against those, especially those monarchs referred to in Psalm 2, which we just recited together, who use even good laws to take away opportunities, who don't use the law to build a society of God's loving justice. It is to those that the promise is that God's anger is kindled quickly. It is also this event a door to the present. The Magi may have wanted to stay in the hut, hang out with the toddler and the Holy Family, but no sooner have they presented their gifts when they are warned in a dream that their journey is not over, and that from now on it's not going to be a friendly one, but a dangerous journey. Here on the Mount, Peter too wants to be in this revelation in a kind of ongoing way, wants to hold on to the moment, the sheer amazingness of it, and understandably so. But right at this point, when we think, okay, for once, Peter's got it right. He's not just a bumbling idiot speaking words he doesn't understand. We would all say the same thing, wouldn't we? We find out that it's not a moment to rest into. It's actually just a bridge moment to the journey, continuing. Only a doorway to living in God's presence in the present. Only a sign of what will come to us if we keep listening to the Beloved. In the contemplative prayer tradition, which I'm certainly no expert in, feel like I'm always starting over with contemplative prayer, but the one thing that I have come to really appreciate is that we're taught not to get too caught up in ecstasies. I come from a charismatic kind of spiritual background, and I know that that's a big temptation for some people to get caught up in the mountain peak moments and then want those moments to be replicated over and over again. But in the contemplative prayer tradition, we learn that these ecstasies will pass. So not to put too much coin on them. But also, just as importantly, not to get too down in our sorrow. This too is merely a constellation of feelings. I say merely. It doesn't feel like that when we're sad or we're in anxiety. But these things are not our destiny. They're a moment. They're a time period. God's presence in our present gives us fresh courage to live, to go down off the mountain or come up out of the valley into the vagaries of daily life, to keep our wits about us and not overreact one way or the other. We are the beloved of the beloved, and therefore we have been given this great gift to listen, to be encouraged. He is the light of the world, and just so, you and I are light for the world. It's tough to say this, but I'm learning in the present to practice something. And I've referred to it probably 4 or 5 times in the last few years in my homilies, because I think it's so important to recite to yourself, to practice in your day, I am God's beloved. I am God's beloved. Look in the mirror and try saying that. Smile at yourself when you're saying it. I may not be the light, but in His light, I am a light for my family, for my neighborhood. And if we look in a mirror and say that to ourselves, we can kind of gulp. It seems so audacious. But here's the truth. I am love. I am light. So are you. The Transfiguration opens a door to our future. In terms of Jesus Himself, we see this to be true. God is determined, and so is Jesus, that He go to Jerusalem and face what needs to be faced alone. So that all our false stopping points, all those points in our journey through life, when we want to indulge ourselves in false security, to make ourselves a little nest egg and get comfortable, and then put our hope in that, can be exposed as finally false and not our final stopping ground. God seems determined to expose all of our victimizing and all victims, so that not only a few are privileged with spiritual experiences like we read in our text today, but that all of us, the whole world, may yet find ourselves in this story. And so there's more for us to be and to do. Certain Gnostic sects wanted the Transfiguration to be the climax of the Christian story. But though it foreshadows the divine desire, it is not itself the path. The event is a doorway to that path. A path that is both paradoxical and yet true to our journeys. A journey we are now about to go on again with Jesus in Lent. Here on this mountain, Jesus is revealed in glory, and there on the hill, Jesus will be revealed in shame. Here His clothes are shining. There His clothes will be stripped from His body, caked in blood. Here He is flanked by the law and the prophets, Moses and Elijah, in extraordinary dignity and fulfillment. There, hung on that awful piece of wood, flanked by 2 criminals. Here, light dazzling from within, and above, a bright cloud suffusing the scene. There and then, a deep darkness will come across the whole land. Here, Peter stutters how wonderful things are, and we relate. Then he will be cursing that he doesn't know, the one. Here, the voice of God affirms what was said at Jesus' baptism, what I've just expressly asked you to practice. Then Jesus will express the shock of forsakenness. This story, then, as a bridge, tells us, points to the fact that success, quote unquote, is not the end goal of the spiritual life. And that actually is good news. Because the last time I checked, most of us are not living a fairy tale. We're in real life. We're suffering. We're having wonderful things happen. We're enjoying successes of our friends and family. But it all ends at some point. The grand, glorious trajectory of the gospel is that God lives our pain and suffering with us, opening up a path of healing, hope, and transformation, not by escaping our troubles, but by coming up out of the valley with us or coming down the mountain with us on the road. And we are the ones, then, through whom this gospel shines, not by everything and in everything done right, but by our embrace of love and forgiveness and the willingness to walk with each other. And so we are not solitary princes or princesses walking on a beach alone in our grief. But at this table, this is the place the penny drops. In his gift, our eyes and ears are opened to each other, daughters and sons of the true King by grace. We're all part of the crown. Amen.